Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. This month, UCL graduate student Michael Pittman explains how a Geological Society-funded research trip led to the discovery of a lifetime. First, the Mars Science Laboratory, the latest rover in NASA's Mars Exploration Program, is scheduled to take off in late 2011. The mission is designed to find out more about whether Mars is, or ever has been, capable of supporting microbial life. Sarah Day spoke to Caltech geologist John Grotziner, the mission's project leader.
The focus on these missions is always, will we find life on Mars? Is that one of the main priorities for sending these rovers, or is that more a kind of media interest?
I think it is very much a media interest, and it's also a driver because the space agency takes care to direct the missions towards the things that the taxpayers are interested in. And, the search for life is a very difficult one because it depends on the preservation of organic matter as a first step before you search for life itself. And it's much more difficult than searching for water. The thing that makes it difficult is because even if life had evolved on Mars, the chances of it being preserved are very small. If we use Earth as a reference, and our planet is teeming with life, yet it rarely preserves evidence of life in the fossil record. The focus now is on exploring for habitable environments. You're looking for water, a source of energy, either solar energy or thermal energy or chemical energy, and then organic carbon, assuming life as we know it on Earth based on carbon. So those are sort of the three things that we're looking for in the course of our mission.
How is this mission different to previous ones?
Well, it's different in a number of ways. The spacecraft itself, the rover, is much, much larger. It literally weighs a ton. It's about 875 kilograms. And it's about the size of a Mini Cooper. Because of that increase in size, we have to land it with a different system. We used to sort of crash land it in the past with airbags surrounding the rover. This time around, we need an active propulsion system that will gently land the rover to the surface, but the rover will be fully assembled and pretty much ready to go.
And what kind of experiments is it going to be doing on the surface?
The rover is called Mars Science Laboratory, and it really is a laboratory. It's different from all of the rovers before it, and that we have on board inside the rover two instruments in particular, one that is designed to search for large molecules of including organic carbon. It can also measure the isotopic ratio of things like oxygen and carbon if we were to find it, possibly sulfur. And the other instrument is able to do X-ray diffraction, which will give us the definitive structure of minerals that we encounter. So samples are drilled. There's a drill. It's about 1.5 centimeters in diameter. It bores a hole in the rock up to 15 centimeters deep, and it returns a powder to the interior of the rover where the powder gets split in half, and each instrument gets half of the sample and does its analysis. And then in addition to that, there's a lot of other instruments as well. There's three sets of cameras that are all high definition, full color. There's a laser that we shoot at the rocks that vaporizes the rock and gives us its chemical composition. And we have a few other things as well.
The latest mission, I mean all these missions, there seems to be an amazing sort of collaboration between different groups of people. There's geologists, engineers, planetary scientists. Does this ever lead to sort of conflict about where to go or what to look for with the missions?
I think all missions that involve a selection of a landing site have historically involved a very rich collaboration of people that bring in different types of expertise and have different experiences. And the challenge is always to be able to narrow down to eventually one site where it is that you want to go. This time around, our landing sites are really all viewed as being excellent. And the choice is going to be made probably largely by scientists because the engineering capabilities are now so good that we don't have to worry about engineers finding some requirement that we've exceeded and then eliminating a landing site for that reason. And so this means that we'll have to really focus our scientific arguments and hopefully wind up with one or two in the end that we can focus on.
You mentioned as well there's this mission in 2018 in collaboration with the European Space Agency to bring back samples to Earth, is that right?
The planning now between NASA and ESA is to deploy a pair of rovers, one of which will be built principally by the European Space Agency, the other one by NASA. The NASA rover will have less capability to do in situ analysis than the ESA rover will, but it will have the capability to collect samples and store them. and eventually then a rocket will leave the surface of Mars, put them into orbit around Mars, and then later on another spacecraft will come and retrieve the sample cache and then bring it back to Earth.
So presumably this involves a lot of new technology about how to bring things back safely to Earth from Mars. Could this be seen as a sort of precursor to manned missions, or is that going a bit far?
Yeah, I think this all sort of goes in that direction because, you know, beginning with Mars Science Laboratory, which is a lot more complicated than the rovers that are up there now that are still active today, that's already a big challenge, and Mars sample return is yet another challenge, and that challenge has the particular task of actually having to land hardware onto the surface of Mars that must then take something off the surface of Mars, escape its gravitational pull, and bring it back to Earth. So it's a natural precursor to human exploration.
Is that something you could see happening anytime soon?
Probably not anytime soon in my lifetime, but I'm sure somewhere down the road somebody's going to give it a try.
John Grotzinger was speaking after his Shell London lecture, which can be viewed along with all our Shell lectures on the Geological Society website. In 2008, UCL graduate student Michael Pittman fulfilled a childhood dream when he discovered a perfectly preserved dinosaur skeleton in the desert of Inner Mongolia. 2 years on, his amazing discovery has been published and is providing important information about dinosaur evolution.
Discovering a dinosaur, is this sort of a lifelong dream that you've had?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. As a kid growing up, I always really liked dinosaurs, and I've always wanted to discover one, and so it was a great surprise. But in paleontology, I guess that's what you do. You discover new things and discuss the science about it, but it definitely, as a kid, it was a dream.
So tell me about the expedition. It was a couple of years ago now, wasn't it?
Yeah, expeditions tend to be very difficult to organise. They can often fall through at last minute, not because of, or sometimes because of funding. So I'm glad that the Society still funds a lot, but a lot of the time it's due to political reasons. The Gobi is kind of quite a remote part of the world. So we actually went in 2008. It was a short expedition of 2 weeks. For 2 weeks we didn't find anything. On the last day we were getting quite upset, and my friend came over with this claw in his hand and showed it to me. You know, we've kind of realized both very quickly that it was a dinosaur, and when we did, it was amazing, all shouting, and I remember at the time everyone was wondering what happened to us, if someone had like tripped over and broken their arm or something, but it was really good, really good.
Do you know straight away if it's a new species, or does that take quite a lot of time?
Well, it depends how well you know your animals. If you can see most of the animal already, then you straight away know what it is. For us, though, we actually only found the claw. So starting with the claw, it's very difficult to know what kind of dinosaur it is. We knew it was a carnivorous dinosaur because of the shape of the claw. But beyond that, it's very difficult to pinpoint what type of dinosaur specifically. So that took a while. And we actually only heard back from the preparators about a year later because it took so long to get out the rock. And so a year later, I got sent a photo, and it was only then when we said, oh, that's that, this is a dromaeosaur, straight away. But before that, it was kind of like we were just eagerly waiting, like waiting for Christmas gifts.
So can you tell me about the significance of the species, why it's so interesting?
Sure. It's from the Cretaceous, which is, I guess, probably most people's favourite. Like dinosaurs like T-Rex were from the Cretaceous. Dromaeosaurs are known best from one genus of dinosaur called Velociraptor, and a lot of people might know, have heard about Velociraptor. And so that's known from several skeletons, one complete one. But apart from that, most other dromaeosaurs, which come from all over the world, those are only really known from, in most part, from very fragmentary material. So what's interesting is that we now have Lynkhoraptor and Velociraptor. So we were able to kind of fill in the gaps of what these animals kind of look like. At the moment, because we have all these different dromaeosaurs and some of them aren't complete, it's very difficult to know what the ancestral condition of these animals are. So now with Lynkhoraptor, we can begin to kind of say with a bit more certainty what the ancestral features of these animals were and how they changed as they became more derived, more advanced.
Well, we've seen some artist impressions of what it might have looked like. How certain can we be about what it looked like?
In our reconstruction of Lynkhoraptor, you can see that it's feathered. And the reason we know that is because many other dromaeosaurs, particularly from northeastern China, Liaoning province, are covered in feathers. Very primitive feathers, not like the kind of branched ones we see in birds today. So in the artist's impression, we've kind of covered it with this very primitive proto-feather. But the colour, we were not sure, because in our specimen, we've only got the skeleton. In Liaoning, you have all the feathers preserved, you have sometimes the gut contents, and even details like the skin over the eye, so it's very beautiful preservation. In terms of its general form, yeah, we're pretty confident that's what it looks like.
And it looks quite small. Is it quite a small dinosaur?
Yeah, well, it's about nearly 2 meters in length. I definitely wouldn't want to meet it in person, although I'm sure it would be very cool to see. It would have been quite ferocious. Linghe raptor and other dromaeosaurs are very agile hunters, and they would have eaten animals such as Protoceratops, these horned dinosaurs. They're animals that basically were the kind of the cows of this time in this area. We have so many of them, so that's probably their most likely food source. But we also find lots of lizards, and so they might have been on the menu as well.
So what kind of environment would they be living in? Is it similar to what you can see now?
Well, there is one environment that people have pinned down as something that's pretty analogous. It's the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa. If any of you have been lucky enough to go there, it's a desert, but a lot of the animals, they tend to live at the edge of very large dune fields. And the reason why they do this is because at the edge of dune fields where the sediments tend to be a bit more stable, you have more chance of having vegetation. That supports, you know, herbivores, which in turn obviously support the carnivores and stuff. And that's kind of the environment that, from the geology, we can actually infer was like in Inner Mongolia. We have beautiful continuous beds that represent the dune fields. So we knew where to look, and it was just a case of wandering around the desert, and we did a lot of that. And we have actually got some more new dinosaurs that we're going to publish soon, so I guess watch this space. So it's a very exciting time for us at the moment.
Are they from the same expedition?
Yeah, exactly. And they were actually found within about 2 or 3 days of each other. It's just to highlight how much luck it is. We basically found all our new species and new dinosaurs right at the end. And in fact, one that's going to be described quite soon, I actually found it because I nearly stepped on it.
And have you got any expeditions coming up in the future?
Yeah, I do. I'm hoping to go to Outer Mongolia this time, to a very remote part of the Gobi Desert. And I hope to go there to look at some earlier dinosaurs, which are very kind of poorly known in that part of the world, and to try and find out how dinosaurs in that part of the world at the time were evolving. I guess there's lots of other places that I'd like to work. But for the moment, Mongolia, and I think I'm very lucky to be able to work there at such a young age.
So lots more exciting discoveries in the future, hopefully.
Yes, hopefully, yeah. My friend, that's on the project, I think he's discovered something like 20, 24, 25 dinosaurs, or something like that. So, I still got a while until I meet him, but I'm sure that, you know, these days with the discoveries we make, I'm sure we'll have many more cool dinosaurs to discover.
Michael Pittman was talking to Sarah Day. You can read more about Michael's research and keep up to date with the latest geological news by visiting Geoscientist Online on the Society's website. In the next episode, Derek Vance from the University of Bristol tells a story of the evolving chemistry of the oceans and what consequences human activity might have in the future.